A Trump Russia and East Greenwich Illusion, Emergent Order and the Gig Economy. I'm Justin Katz, and this is Last Impressions number 23.
La 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 la.
I've discovered unlimited music from Amazon. It's on a special if you're a Prime member. And so I declared yesterday, actually, Van Morrison Day. It turns out it's got to be more like Van Morrison Week because the guy's got a lot of albums. So I couldn't resist opening with a little bit of that. So other than that, the big news, of course, is that Don Jr. had a meeting with somebody from Russia. Proof. Smoking gun. You know, of course, when it's Hillary Clinton's server, there's no smoking gun. I mean, the server, as many argued, was the smoking gun. But in that case, no smoking gun unless you have an email or some communication that says Hillary Clinton said, hey, go set up this illegal thing so that I can get away with stuff. That doesn't count. Now this is a smoking gun. You know, even the worst version of the latest revelations looks pretty much like nothing to me. I mean, So Donald, President Trump's son met with a Russian lawyer who apparently was let into the country without a visa in order to meet with the Obama administration and the Justice Department and had some stuff going on there. But, you know, she also she promised the Trump campaign dirt on Hillary Clinton's involvement with the Russian government. And that Don Jr. said, I love it. I'll come listen to you. So he went and listened to the pitch, and apparently the meeting lasted 20 minutes and everybody said nothing here and left. But this is being promoted as proof of collusion. I think it disproves collusion, doesn't it? I mean, the email says, you know, hey, if this random Russian lawyer knows something, that'd be great to know. If they were already colluding, wouldn't that be... Would they not need this, or wouldn't they be checking with their secret illegal sources to make sure that this woman's got something? I mean, the only way this has any relevance at all is if you're assuming that they're all lying now, that there was nothing and this was actually just the first meeting. But that's an additional storyline that you need additional proof for. But, you know, the frustrating thing is that the news media and the whole political elite downplayed, brushed aside very real evidence of, you know, constitution level scandals with Obama and, for that matter, Hillary Clinton. So, you know, no, I've said this before and I'll probably keep saying it for the next 3 to 7 years, but I don't like Trump as a character. I don't know him as a person, but as a character, as a public figure, as a president. I mean, he's doing some stuff I like, but as you know, the character of a president, I don't particularly like him. And, you know, I just don't believe anything at all that the news media reports about this administration. They aren't giving news. I think Rush Limbaugh had it put it well. They're attempting a coup. Seriously. I mean, this is, I wrote down a quote from Rush because I can't access the audio. I'm not a subscriber. But here's how Rush Limbaugh put it. He says, but again, with this, there's nothing. What there is a hope, another little carrot dangling in front of the media and the Democrats that they can make this instance into something that would convince the American people that the Trump campaign was willing to work with the Russians to sabotage Mrs. Clinton. And that's Rush Limbaugh. And note that. The argument here that we're hearing everywhere is that Don Jr. was willing to meet with the Russians to sabotage Clinton, the opposing candidate. Well, you know, look. Obama, Clinton, the news media, all of these elite insiders are perfectly willing to work with anybody, including people obviously breaking the law by sharing classified information. They're willing to work with anybody to sabotage President Trump. And they did the same thing to Bush before him and probably Reagan, too, in the 80s. And I wasn't really paying attention yet. I wasn't out of high school. And, I mean, look at the other side. Look at the contrast. And I know we're in the era where whataboutism is out of fashion because it hurts all the wrong people. But what about the other side? What about the Obama administration? Gun running? You in the media yawned. Obama, the administration using the IRS to target political opposition? You yawned. For 8 years, we had the sleepiest news media in the world, it seemed like, except those under dictatorships. And now this stuff is worth hyperventilating about? I don't think so. Sorry. I mean, look, I'm not a fan of Trump, but I'm not defending this. But it's about what I expected. I mean, isn't it what you expected? I mean, I don't mean, you know, I assume most national level politicians do or would do this kind of stuff, but they'd have secondary, third, tertiary, somebody lower down the chain clear everything all the way up until there you have this kind of an email saying, "Hey, I love it." What I expected was the ham-handedness. And, you know, voters disagreed, or at least disagreed that it was a problem. So, yeah, Don Jr. made a politically unwise decision, and this proves him to be a non-politician, a non-political pro. Well, gee, I mean, that's going to be devastating for the Trump presidency, right? That he's being proven, it's being proven that he's not a politician. His family aren't politicians. You know, again, I was mostly never Trump during the election. So, look, if I'm feeling this way, I'd surmise it's common wisdom among those who were neutral Trump or pro-Trump or pro-Trump curious that this is just nonsense and that this is what they expected and more or less what they wanted. At worst, it's a byproduct, this kind of amateur hour stuff from the campaign and the administration is a byproduct of the quality that they wanted, which was somebody to go in there and say, you know what, forget your silly rules. We're not going to play the game in order to serve the political elite and meet their etiquette. We're going to do it in a way to win and to get effect and get the effects that our voters want. You know, as Rush, and this goes to it, as Rush Limbaugh pointed out, in that monologue that I just quoted, they released the email. I mean, Hillary Clinton hid her email server in a bathroom, right? Wiped it, what, with a cloth, as she said, pretending ignorance. I mean, give me a break. I mean, even a Wall Street Journal in a front page story yesterday was talking about how this seems to indicate, appears to indicate, I think the language was, that there was at least a willingness to collusion. Well, no, this doesn't indicate any kind of collusion. This indicates meeting with somebody to get see if there's actually some information out there. So, you know, the whole thing is just mind boggling. You know, and I can't help but see a connection, and I'm sure a lot of people are going to think this is a stretch, but I can't help but see a connection with the union performance at an East Greenwich town council meeting earlier this week. If you haven't heard about it, the town council is doing a lot of things that the established players like the teachers union, the NEA, don't like. And so they're ramping up the heat, and they did the typical, you know, to the textbook script of going, the union, highly paid six figure union, thugs went to the town council meeting, did a lot of shouting, got the town council president all flustered, and they ended up canceling the meeting. And now it's, you know, Rhode Island Future is taking that as an excuse to go around saying, oh, the government is not working. The government isn't even able to operate in East Greenwich, which is ridiculous. But, and I had a post on this on The Current if you are interested. And I also discussed it at pretty good length in a really good segment with John DePietro this week. So that'll be this weekend's podcast if you want to look for it. But the whole idea, and we've seen this forever. I started noticing it in the late zeros, and, you know, like 2009 in East Providence. But the idea is to sow confusion, a false sense of danger and calamity. And that's all that is in East Greenwich. And it's all this is in the news media over this Trump-Russia thing. As far as I can see, there's still, every time there's this, ooh, a smoking gun, ooh, this is the evidence we've been looking for. It's nothing. I'm sorry. That's just my objective analysis. So in East Greenwich, you get union thugs shouting, "We can't hear you," you know, shouting that out as some guy, you know, they do this at every meeting in order to intimidate a 76-year-old taxpayer or something, to make them feel nervous at the microphone. That's only a union thug thing. And it's not only a union thug thing. I mean, this is what we're seeing nationally from the news media, is that they're trying to whip up this feeling that everything's falling apart and we're being governed by the Manchurian candidate. And it's about what you would expect, right? You know, I mean, whether or not you agree with me, pause for a second and imagine, put yourself in a frame of mind where you feel like there's this conspiracy of sorts, this national movement among an elite to kind of discount democracy and make everything run by bureaucrats and an international elite. And so they work across borders, you know, the former president, apart from gun running and sicking the IRS on Tea Party groups, also was trying to undermine the Israeli government and their politics and cooperating. You know, you had the famous hot mic conversation with a Vladimir Putin stooge saying, "Tell Vlad," from Obama, you know, when he didn't know the mic was on, tell Vlad that I'll have more flexibility when my next election's over. I mean, you have all that. You have ample evidence of Clinton and the Clinton Foundation doing all sorts of stuff that should really has not thoroughly been vetted and prosecuted, in my opinion. Of course, you would, if that's your worldview, and it's mine, you would look at this, whether or not you like Trump, and you would say they're making the opposition, the other side, is throwing out the smokescreen, trying to make all this noise so that we look away from what they have done, what they are doing, and what they're willing to do in the future, and concentrate on this little minutia, these little controversies in a bottle. And it's what you would expect them to do. And it's completely coherent with that worldview. And I haven't seen any evidence to push me off that worldview yet. And I haven't been avoiding evidence. I haven't seen it. What's really disappointing, frankly, is that so many people who ought to know better are falling for it. And that's true in East Greenwich with the town council president, you know, shouting back at the union thugs, although maybe there's no reason she should know who they were, what they were doing, if she hasn't done this before. But nationally, you've got political analysts really just hopping on this and getting whipped up. And you kind of want to say to them, look, just pause and ask yourself what this really is and what's really going on there. So I'm going to put a ribbon on that as my rant for the week, because I want to get to a topic. It was, again, as so often happens, it was on the Econ Talk podcast with Russ Roberts. And the topic, I'm catching up, having been very busy, still very busy, but I'm catching up. And the topic a few episodes ago was emergent order. And Russ Roberts was speaking with the economists Don Boudreau and Michael Munger. And the quick summary is, emergent order, in some respects, it's a lot like the image of the invisible hand. But it's the idea that all of our incentives and the things that drive us individually and as communities force a sort of cooperation that causes our market to go in certain directions in an orderly fashion, that it just emerges out of this mix of incentives and circumstances. So how, you know, you need this much money for this reason, and you're in this in this industry, in this time when this happens, as a natural circumstance in a natural world, you know, a shortage of this or a surplus of that. And everybody just naturally kind of responds in a way that makes it look like there's some coordination. And the classic example is the Italian city that always has fresh bread in the morning. You would think there's some bread czar who's making sure that happens, but there doesn't have to be because of this emergent order. But and I have a post on some of that on the current right now as well. But there's a deeper point that I wanted to delve into here, and I'll start it off. Here's a clip from. This is Russ Roberts, the host of this show. He's talking about this idea of the invisible hand.
it becomes a straw man for people who want to intervene in markets by saying, oh, you know, you economists, some of you think that the invisible hand solves everything. Well, it doesn't solve everything. It doesn't solve lots of things. And there's a case to be made for regulation in lots of areas, pollution being one of them that I would mention, although maybe other ways of solving it other than certain kinds of regulation that we have. But certainly the invisible hand is not going to solve pollution all magically the way it solves, effectively the way it solves the problem of how we're going to get enough bread in the city tomorrow.
Now I want to proceed hesitantly and with expressions of respect for economists who know this material much, much better than I do. But, you know, it seems like Roberts is missing the point in some respects here. The invisible hand, properly construed, I would say, does not solve any problems. It's a process. Now, we could get into semantics about what a problem is. I mean, obviously, you might say evolution, which is a similar concept in biology, solves the problem of how do these animals reach the leaves up in the tops of the trees, and you know, over generations, you get giraffes. You know, you could say that solves the problem, but the even the idea though of problems. Injecting the idea of solving problems. I mean, you might be using the word challenges would be more objective, but solving are obstacles. But if you're a problem implicitly has a moral character. If it's a problem, it means one thing is better than another thing. So in that regard, the invisible hand, the emergent order, it's not moral. It's not good. It's not bad. Without intent, you have no good, bad, morality. You have no problem if there's not somewhere you are trying to get, then there's nothing. There's no problem. There are obstacles. There are challenges, maybe, but it's not a problem. So, you know, that kind of comes to our role as human beings is to intend something, to set goals and objectives and assert and figure out what is good and what is bad, and then acknowledge forces like evolution or emergent order in working toward our intended end. So you can't say, okay, we have a problem and we're going to use the invisible hand to solve this problem. It's more like we have a problem if the invisible hand is pushing in this direction, we have to react accordingly. I think these economists know this, especially the free market ones. Maybe they don't understand how their language affects the thinking of those who don't know the subject matter. And honestly, actually, a lot of the economists probably do get caught up in erroneous thinking in philosophical terms because their language smuggles in moral concepts that really don't belong in the conversation. And that gets very interesting when another of the economists on a show, Michael Munger, and the other one, Don Boudreau, later on agrees with this. But Michael Munger, this is Michael Munger I'm about to play in a clip, but he brings in this idea of evolution and biology and how that plays into the idea of emergent order.
Why is it that those people who are most likely to dismiss any creationist account of biology reject the watch? They want to carry out the watchmaker analogy when it comes to social processes, because when they see markets, they want design. And it actually tends to be inversely correlated. It's the people who are most sure that there's no such thing as a watchmaker in nature who want one in social processes.
So Munger opens that clip with a question. Why is it that they reject, they demand emergent order in nature, but reject it in economics and social processes? Well, the answer, I think, may be because they don't like the moral conclusions that you get from nature. If nature does appear to have an emergent order, and it's going in a direction, and you have any sense at all that that natural direction, whether it's the intent of God or however else you want to put it, that that natural direction sort of defines good, or at least makes a strong case for being good, if then that will dictate certain conclusions about how you ought to act and behave morally. There's a long, such as monogamy and marriage, for example, and there's a long background, a long history of wanting to reject those moral conclusions. And a lot of it, frankly, comes from the fact that moral thinkers, particularly in our society for thousands of years in the Catholic Church, and also Jewish thinkers, but that general Judeo-Christian direction, have spent a lot of time over millennia looking at natural law, and this goes back to Greeks and philosophy as well, looking at the natural world and drawing conclusions from that. St. Paul says, you can know God from his creation. And that's essentially what philosophers and theologists have been doing. And if you spend a few thousand years looking at that creation and coming to certain conclusions about how people ought to behave, and then you get a flash of lightning in modernity, you get people saying, you know what, I don't want to live like that, I'm going to redefine the source of good, then you reject nature. You reject the idea of any intent in nature at all. On the other hand, in economics, what they want to do is they want to control things. So they will assume that somebody, in order to gain the moral justification to control other people's behavior in economics, economically, socially, in that way, they have to assume that somebody else is doing the controlling now. So they're saying nature does its thing, and it dictates good, and but it's just a pure process, so we should heed it and not assume that there's an intent there that goes against our own personal intents. But whereas with the economy, they literally want to tell people what they have to do. So when they look to nature, they're saying, you can't tell me what to do, whether that you is the church or God or nature. You can't tell me what to do. But in economics, they do want to tell people what to do. So they have to put forward this sort of take this approach of thinking that somebody else is already planning everything and dictating everything. But right now it's the rich, greedy, evil white people, men. And so that's not fair. So since somebody's controlling it anyway, we can use government to control it. Now I do think, I have to acknowledge that I'm not offering here a fully formed package. And so in some regards, my thinking is possibly contradictory or at least a little muddled. And I have the feeling that if I kept working through it, this is how these things work. If I keep working through it, I can see there's light. I can see that these ideas can be brought together to a coherent whole. I'm just not there yet. But I think part of what happens on both sides of the aisle, so to speak. So if we assume, let's take for granted that Munger and Boudreau have a point that let's say progressives believe in the good of nature. But I think you also have to concede that free marketers, particularly libertarians, also end up taking the market as the definition of good. And so everybody on both sides, you kind of wind up worshiping forces. So the free marketers do tend to conclude ultimately that the market brings about good, because you do need a standard for good. And if you reject God, if you reject natural intent to the universe, as Boudreau later says he does explicitly, then the emergent order, the marketplace, might as well be it. There's a reasonable argument in that those who reject the good of the market are often just privileging the goods that they can see over the goods that they can, by which I mean that, if you have to come up with a standard for good, the market is coordinating all sorts of different things, including everybody's intentions, and balancing them through prices. And so that's about, if you accept that complexity, that's about as the market is doing as about as good a job as possible at balancing everybody's interests. And that, you know, that might as well be, you might as well take that as good. What is the definition of what is good? And if you don't do that, the free marketer might say, and I agree with this, I guess, to a certain extent, if you reject that, all you're really doing is saying, I am privileging what I think is good, this person eating, this person getting health care, I'm privileging that over, or the progressive is privileging that over all of the bad that they can't see. So you're feeding that person today, but you're starving, you know, like the butterfly who causes a hurricane in chaos theory. You're feeding that person today, getting them a full meal of steak and potatoes, but you're starving a whole country somewhere, you know, in a way that it all works out ultimately. You can't see that, but if you reject the market, which is just naturally coordinating, you're privileging what you can see over what you can't. Of course, none of these conversations can take place without acknowledging that, you know, progressives are less coherent. So on the one hand, they'll tend to think similarly about, say, the forces of nature that they bring about good, naturally. But on the other hand, in rejecting this sort of the emergent order in society, they want to manipulate human nature and society in a direction that they pick just based on whatever, based on emotion. And that generates an incoherency. I mean, on one hand, you're privileging natural processes. On the other hand, you're rejecting them. There's just no coherent. The source ultimately is the individual, but you still have to rely on, you know, nature, and you still can give certain people power over others and reject everything you've already been saying about how people are greedy. I don't know. Like I said, I'm not. This is the work of a lifetime. So, I mean, it could be that progressives are just ultimately more thoroughly about rejecting God than offering a coherent view, because the social order that they reject, as I said, is essentially a function of his influence. Libertarians aren't quite as vehemently rejecting that sense of intent to the universe. They just, I don't know, tend to want to write it out of governing processes. And there are problems with that too, but I think it's time to change gears a little bit. So we should, I think, embrace emergent order. I mean, it empowers us to figure out the best way to work things. Once we've set a goal, once we know where we want to go, relying on the natural processes and not fighting them or rejecting them is the better way to go. And individually, I think we ought to embrace this concept economically, in what is called, say, a gig economy, where everybody can use technology, transportation, communications, internet, you know, apps, Uber, all that stuff, to find a maximum niche for their intentions and their talents. And that way they don't have to get in this sort of rut of working for another company towards somebody else's intentions. But those of us who think this way, that way, have to be cognizant of the insecurity that generates. And I was thinking of this today because I came across an essay by Joel Kotkin, I think that's correct pronunciation, you can get it on Real Clear Politics, and I'll have the link on this post that goes with this podcast. But he's attempting to explain why socialism is gaining in popularity, and he, I don't know if he coined it or what, but he uses the term precariat, which is a play on proletariat, you know, the working people in Marxism. And to him, the precariat is the younger generation, the millennials, people who are working, maybe all these little pieces, trying to piece together a living, but they feel insecure and they're on the edge. And that's whom he says the socialists are now appealing to. And so here's a paragraph from from Kotkin. The precariat has rational reasons to embrace socialism, particularly if capitalism seems unlikely to meet their needs. The notion of getting a steady, well-paid, full-time job has vanished for an increasing number of young people. Most millennials are not doing as well as their parents did at the same age. The idea of buying a house, once a sure sign of upward mobility, has declined in much of the U.S. for the current generation, particularly on the coasts, and even more so in the U.K., where house prices are higher and incomes are lower. So that's how Kotkin explains why millennials and such are vulnerable to socialists, the lures of socialists. There's something of an irony here. Like the union thugs and the anti-Trump news media, the progressives or socialists, they've just been lying for generations, sowing confusion. And that's what's generating this idea that if I'm insecure, I should turn to the socialists. So young adults have been led to reject, this is the irony I'm talking about, young adults have been led to reject the social things that lead to stability, the acknowledgement of human nature, of nature. Basically, this comes down to marriage and all of its interactions with monogamy, restraint, parenthood. And now, so that's what's leading to this anxiety. And also fundamentally to that, not just marriage, but the rejection of God, of religion, of something to give a fundamental meaning to your life, no matter what happens to you, where you're not the slave of your circumstances, because whatever happens, it's only part of a larger universal story, a larger mission, a larger purpose. So now that you've got this society of individual, extreme individualism and anxiety and fear of a lack of stability, and because nature is unstable to a large extent, and what they're being told, what the socialists are telling them, is that your anxiety is purely economic. It doesn't have to do with, you know, the fact that you're biologically, your nature wants you to be having children. Your emotions want you to be in a stable relationship with another person who cares about you and that you can trust, and who the two of you pair up as if you are a single person, a single entity. That's what marriage is supposed to do. So what they're saying is your anxiety is not based on that. It's not based on the fact that you've covered yourselves in piercings and tattoos and reject a lot of the former notions about hard work that an employer might want. And no, it's just a matter of privilege. You're unprivileged. You should be able to do whatever you want. And of course, one of the big lies of this is that the people who are supposedly privileged aren't doing whatever they want. They're following these sort of rules that bring about stability. But what I think is really important here is that those of us who believe in the good of the market and that individuals can capture that good through something like a gig economy, we are behind in coming up with a competing explanation that offers stability, that leads you to stability. You know, frankly, millennials can have it much, much better than prior generations. I mean, look at the wonders of modern technology. This is something they don't understand. Cell phones. I mean, it's just every aspect of your life is made easier and less full of anxiety because you can carry this thing around anywhere, almost any problem. I don't know. I don't want to go too far, but in most places on the planet that you would want to go, you can bring this little thing and at any point call for help, find out where you are, look up information. What do I do if I'm bit by a snake? Google, you know. It's a wonder. I mean, I started by talking about the Amazon Music. I can, any artist that I want to review all of their albums, any song I want to find, almost. I don't have Tupelo Honey by Van Morrison, which was really weird. But is there, right there. So young adults should and can have it much, much better than prior generations. But you can't also reject human nature and the culture that got us to this point, that evolved in acknowledgement of nature over thousands of years. You can't just reject that and then say, I want that and modernity too, and all this technology and stability. You can't reject the things that our culture has figured out over thousands of years, bring you stability and allow you to advance and take risks within stability and still get the stability. That's what the socialists are promising, but it's just a lie. So, you know, again, the Center for Freedom and Prosperity just put out a recent ad, audio ad, I guess you'd say. This one about a robot who's taken somebody's job. And I encourage you to go find it. It's on the Ocean State Current and rifreedom.org as well. And probably find it elsewhere. Who knows? But the theme of that, and a theme I'm getting to here, is that this is all about competing visions. You can follow that evolved traditional path toward a successful, fulfilling life, which, yes, will put some burdens of restraint on you, require some delayed gratification, some acceptance of limits on your behavior, and respect for the way other people are going to react to you based on how you present yourself. So you can accept those limited voluntary restraints and follow a traditional path, or you can listen to the schemers who will tell you that you can have it all. You know, you can behave however you want, and there will always be another safety net, and they'll take money from those greedy business owners and they'll give it to you. The catch is, apart from selling your soul, I think literally, but at least metaphorically, to the progressives who will then require you to go on to accept some other premise that they're pushing in order to make the world crazy. But the bigger catch, the more practical catch, is that it doesn't work. It can't work. It's built on a lie. And the incentives it creates, the emergent order that it sets in motion, bring you to Venezuela, bring you to chaos. And that is just not good.